Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady and this is podcast number 216. This week, Youngston Anthony is joined by a player who, for those of us of a certain age, will start to bring back memories of good times at Celtic Park and also, strangely enough, of the player who replaced him at Celtic Park. He's joined by Dom Sullivan. Dom joined Celtic from Aberdeen in 1979 and was a core part of the central midfield at the club in the title-winning teams of 81 and 82. What has Dom etched in my memory are the teams that I can start to remember vividly and recant as being the first Celtic teams I knew of by heart, but also from the young player who then eventually prompted Dom's eventual departure from Celtic on a free transfer to Morton, and that was one of the greatest players I've ever seen, Paul McStay. But enough of me rambling, this is him, St Anthony, with him, Dom Sullivan.
It's a pleasure to speak to Dom Sullivan today on the Celtic Underground podcast. So we'll start quickly, Dom. The thing we always ask when we have a podcast is, what was your first Celtic game you remember and who was your first Celtic hero?
Probably the first Celtic game was the first game I was at. I was taken for my birthday by a wee woman called Mary Gallagher. Mary Moll, she was married, my married name. Still alive, still a big Celtic fan, still gets a copy of the Celtic View sent to her every week, still keeps in touch, although she's in her early 80s now. And I think it was Celtic Dunfermline at Parkhead.
What year would that have been?
I was in the whole, that'd be
roughly
60s or something like that. 1960s, 1959, 60s, round about that era. I remember Celtic 1-2-1, you know, quite a time ago. But Mary gave me my first Celtic scarf, which was obviously a handout, as it was in the days. Just delighted to have one, you know.
So you then started your career in St Roch. So tell us about their famous old bathtub they had back in the day.
The famous what?
Bathtub.
Oh, the bathtub. Oh, with a shamrock on it. Oh, unique. Absolutely unique. And I think when Wally Smith, who I signed for at St Roch, Wally's still going about as well. His sons have got some pubs in the town. Vale, Smith's up, Bishop Briggs, and a few others. And when Wally asked me to sign, I was playing with St Roch's. I was playing with Bromwell Gasworks, and we were playing in a cup semi-final against Aberdeen Gasworks at St Roch's Park, and we won 9-1 and I scored 7. So Wally, right after the game, leafed me in to his wee room, persuaded me to sign for St Roch's, and not that I needed a lot of persuading, I couldn't believe anybody was wanting to pay me 10 bob a week for playing football for a start. And the famous story is when we eventually sat down, he promised me £10 signing on, which he gave me £5 that day, and promised me another £5 when I came to training on Monday. I went up the road, gave my man £3, and on that day the Bromwell team were going into town for a wee celebration. I didn't drink, I was only about 16, 17, but I had to go because my meal went. Somewhere into town. The reason I had to go up the road because somebody stole my socks. I had to go and get a new pair of socks. One of the boys took my socks on. Anyway, that's just too easy. But what big persuasion was, when Wally showed me around, he took me in, and here was this bath, a mosaic, a shamrock.
Apparently it was quite famous in junior football.
Oh, it's infamous, infamous. It was fabulous. It was just fabulous. I remember one occasion, and I was just new to the team, big guy who's still about too, Brian Boyle, who'd come for down the Gallagher area, big Brian Boyle. After training, I'm the young rookie, and the water used to drip, let the hot water drip, because I think we're going to free for gasworks. You know, it's how they piped it, and I don't know, but the hot water used to drip, and it was boiling hot. And it was always who was the bravest to get in, because you weren't allowed to put cold water in it. You're allowed to put bodies in it, which brought the level of the water up, right? So you were actually getting covered, covered in water. And there was about 15, 60 squeezed into this wee bath. And I always remember sitting beside Brian Boyle and the water's rising. I'm saying, oh, this is great. Terrible night it was. We came in for training. Black, obviously playing the Black Ash. And Black swirling about in front of us. And I'm saying to myself, this big guy's touching me up, you know? So I sort of moved away. And I nudged him like that, gave him a nudge. You at? The big guy says, I'm having a pee, son. He says, you'll never have plucks in this team. So that's a story behind the old Shamrock bath. Unfortunately, they eventually took it away and put shimmers in when they renewed the park. You know?
So for there, you moved on to Clyde and you made a bit of an influence for yourself, but Archie Robertson was a big influence for you?
Well, Archie Robertson was the main influence of my whole career. And if people knew the influence that Archie Robertson had on other people, in particular Jock Steen, he was actually Jock Steen's mentor, unknown to me until years later. I remember when I signed for Clyde, Archie showed me the fundamentals of strength of the ball, took the Tanner ball player out of me a lot, because that was my boy Sullivan away back then, and Archie taught me the way the game should be played, and that's the passing the game, how to pass the ball, how to strike the ball, put my foot, my leg in a position, which was quite painful, but over the years I practiced it. And I always remember saying that the way to practice this is against the two big walls at Shawfield at the entrance, which are no longer there. And I used to, I worked in six chambers then, and I was always in there about 5 o'clock, trained in after 6:30, and I would be practicing this against the wall, these two walls. And unknown to me, the navy blue Mercedes that was sitting in the big car park at Shawfield was actually Jock Steen's. And he was there 2-3 times a week, because Archie Robertson was a very intellectual type of person. He was a BSc graduate, scholar at Glasgow University, Masters. Very well-spoken man. A man whose theory of the game was a very much of his time, Mourinho type. If you retain the ball, the other team can't score. And he put a whole theory of knowledge into me in the playing of the game. And obviously, Jock's team was a big admirer of Archie. And the theory of the game, how if you kind of break them down one side, you go up the other side, and as you keep stretching them, I remember him using the analogy, if you keep stretching something, what happens? It's an elastic band, it'll eventually burst, snaps, and you'll get through it. And I remember after a game, we went for a, when I joined Clyde, the average age was 31, and within a year, the average age was 19, and I was part of that sort of revolution along with Danny McGrain, God rest him,
which Danny's
the cousin, Danny, who was my best pal, who was I was his best man at his wedding.
Brian Ahern,
Alan Swan.
Phil Kearney.
Well, we're good, you know your stuff, Phil Kearney, aye. We had a few older heads who helped. Jimmy Burns was one.
But Archibald had been there at that time, is that?
Archibald came after I left. Well, it didn't, it came when I was still there, actually, before I went to Aberdeen. But he came into the team, Joe Ward. You know, there was some good players.
So, but in the mid-1970s, you're making a big impression. You've got a couple of camps for Scotland under 23, which is a big thing for a Clyde player at the time.
Well, yeah, especially a part-timer.
So you're one of the no exaggeration to say, you're one of the most highly rated youngsters in the game. And there was always paper talk at the time that Leeds United were after you, Celtic were after you, Dundee United were after you, but for some reason Clyde never let you go.
Well, these facts are true, because in later years I found out from the minutes of the meeting, in particular the minutes of Clyde, which were made available through different people to me. The 1969, Jock made an approach for me, and he offered 25,000 plus two or three players. And I remember the three players were Jimmy Quinn, Pat McCluskey and John Gorman. So it was two players plus 25 grand. But unknown to me, the Clyde board then were, or Clyde were owned by the Duns, Dun and Moore.
The Ginger people.
And they wanted 125,000. They wanted cash. And subsequently, that was the same situation when Leeds came in. Leeds wanted to take me away.
This was about the time of Don Ravey and Billy Brennan.
Yeah, this is early 70s. Leeds wanted to take me away. They were playing a European semi-final. They wanted to take me away for a week with them to see how I could fit in as a young boy coming, you know, coming from Glasgow. And I always remember the manager then was Stan Anderson. Stan phoned me and said, "Your passport in order?" I says, "Aye." He says, "I'll phone you back. It was a Sunday. I'll phone you back tonight. Don't leave the house." He says, you maybe can go down to Leeds tomorrow morning first thing." And I was stayed with anticipation, and nothing happened. And I went and nothing happened at all. I phoned Stan and there was no reply.
No agents in these days, obviously.
Well, they're no agents. You know, just the mushroom treatment. They're kept in the back, kept in the dark and fed, you know.
Crap.
Crap. So I went to training the next night. Stan never says anything to me. After training, I says, "What happened?" He says, "I fell through." And I subsequently found that Clyde were looking for £20,000 as insurance in case I got hurt in the week I was away. But the deal was more or less signed.
That was pretty small-minded, considering what they were getting in return.
So.
And McLean tried to get you to Tannadice a couple of times, didn't he?
Jim McLean eventually signed me. He tried to get me up to Tannadice, but I mean, I was going to have to go up there and live. I was the sole provider in the house, my mother. We moved from Blackcollop to Robrotterson Avenue. So I was the sole provider. And what he was offering me, and having to go live there, wasn't going to be, you know, it was going to be detrimental in my life, you know, looking after my mother. So I had to turn them down.
So by the time Aberdeen came in, then Ali McLeod was the manager, and had you sort of given up hope at a move at that point? Were you getting frustrated?
See, what happens is, what happens to you in situations like that, and I found in when I was managing myself, the longer a player, there's a problem with a young player moving on, then people start to think, you know, there are problems, there's other background problems to the situation. You know, as he's got problems outside the game, is he a bad influence? Which was all, there was no foundation to that. It was just the fact that Clyde had this figure in their head, and they were only prepared to deal with hard cash for Dom Sullivan, and they were protecting their own interest all the way along, to their detriment, because eventually I was there nearly seven seasons before I moved. And when I moved, the impact was quite dramatic right away. You know, I moved for, I think it was 35,000, 40,000 Ali paid for me. Aberdeen, and moved to Aberdeen alongside Stuart Kennedy at the same time. We formed a fabulous right-wing partnership.
There was a famous game, you beat at Rangers 5-1 in the semi-final.
We beat 5-1, in fact, we're watching it in here a fortnight ago. You'll get the game on...
It's still on YouTube.
It's on YouTube, yeah. And I didn't realise I had such a significant role to play in that game. Only when I look back, I was involved in, I think I was involved in four of the goals. Stuart was talking about that. Stuart Kennedy comes in here from time to time. But we formed a really good relationship, and we changed the whole pattern of fitness. At Aberdeen, they thought us to, because both me and Stuart played in under-23s, he came for Falkirk, and we were very fit, but when we were up there, they thought, "Oh, they're these two boys for the backwoods coming, you know, who they think they're, they'll be fit." And there was a sort of regime there that, no, you're not supposed to get in front of them when you're training and things like that. No, we just ran away from them. And it was their problem to keep up with us. So we set a whole standard of fitness and a whole standard of one for all and all for one. And that team, and it bore fruit, obviously, because in 76... That was a final.
What's your recollection of that day?
Again, these things pass that quick. You know, it was, a fantastic day. To go to a final almost within a year of joining Aberdeen and have such a good team, you know, with Wally Muller and McLeish and Rugby and Bobby Clark, these type of players.
Arthur
Graham Bumper, who actually started to form the basis of what Fergie took the full accolades for.
Because Ali laid the groundwork, didn't he, Ali McLeod?
Well, Ali, without doubt, laid the groundwork and set the backbone of the whole structure there. And Big Billy came. Eventually, when Ali moved to Scotland, and Big Billy came, Billy looked and went, Billy did nothing for 2 months. He just looked about and says, "All I can do is add a bit to this. There's nobody here really I want to let go. Mm-hmm. He says, so he brought Archibald in.
Stacking.
He brought Stacking in. And really, that was the main two he brought in and added to the squad, you know.
But would it be fair to say, by the time Ferguson came, that you and Ferguson didn't see eye to eye?
Well, that's another story. What happened then was, when Fergie came, I'd played something like, I'd missed two games the previous season. The whole season I played, I missed two games.
So me and Stuart, and it was a mainstay more or less the team. Within 2 to 3 weeks, I found myself in the reserves, and I didn't know why. So I went to see the manager, and just as he was trying to bring Strachan, he wanted me to play in a wide position. I wasn't prepared to play in a wide position. I said, I'm prepared to play anywhere. But anyway, ended up reserves. The bottom line is, I found out about, must have been 5 or 6 years later, what was actually behind the whole situation was unknown to me within a fortnight of Big Brother leaving. He made an offer, he made an approach to take me to Celtic. And subsequently, Fergie thought there was there was something underhanded. He thought there was something going on between Anne, knew nothing about it. And I can say this day, with my right hand to God, I knew nothing about it. And it ended up in the reserves for seven, eight months. In fact, 3 months into it, Jock Wallace offered £120,000 for me when he went down to
Leicester City.
Fergie turned it down. I went to see Fergie, but he was determined to. I was the first to get the situation, the hairdryer treatment, because I remember going to see him. And he says, I went in for sale. It's in his plans. I'm saying, well, in his plans, why am I training with reserves? I subsequently went to the chairman, who had a great relationship, Dick Donald, fantastic man, lovely man. Because it was starting to affect my home life as well. I was unhappy, my wife was unhappy. I'm saying, what's happened to me? What have I done wrong? And I was one of the one of the senior players who wanted Fergie as a follow-on, because I'd never seen myself coming back to Celtic at that time, in 27. So I was, I was with a great team spirit at Aberdeen, and I knew there was success in the way. But anyway, it wasn't to be, so I eventually went to see the chairman. The chairman said, I didn't realise you were unhappy. Called Fergie at the boardroom, quizzed him on the fact that I was training reserves, and what was it about, and why wasn't I made available for transfer, or well, he's in my plans, he says, and it's just that my training regime only accounts for so many players, just a lot of bullshit. And the chairman says, well, I think if he's in your plans, you should make, you should change your training routines to accommodate Dom. And we obviously wasn't happy. So I had the meeting, it was open air. I went away back down, I always did a bit extra in the afternoon with Stuart Kennedy. We were in the gym 10 minutes and I got told that I was to go up to Fergie's office. Up his office, a pokey office, no one doing it. And I stood, and I remember standing in front of him, and he started shouting and swearing at me, don't you ever go to my chairman. I said, excuse me, I says, I can speak without swearing. I've got a wee bit of grey matter, I hope, and we can discuss things as adults. Don't you tell me, lady, and he just took a swipe and he cleared his desk and told me to get F out of his office. I was the first one to get the hairdryer treatment.
And how did the move to Celtic come about?
Well, the move came, there was a wee bit of strategy to it. If you want honest truth, Fergie phoned me out. I worked in the afternoons. I had wee jobs to keep myself busy. I had a wee business in Aberdeen. And they phoned me, and I wasn't in. My wife took the call. I phoned them back at 8 o'clock at night. She says, come in tomorrow morning, pick your boots up. You're going to Dundee United. You're going to Dundee United. Mm-hmm. Oh, I says, I am. Yes, I've came to a deal with Jim McLean. I says, well, I'm very sorry. I says, I'll speak to Mr. McLean. I says, but I don't think I'll be moving to Dundee. I says, my wife's a teacher. She can't get a job in Aberdeen, Dundee. I says, I'm happy in Aberdeen, and I'm not prepared to go to Dundee just to satisfy your needs. But I'll speak to Mr. McLean. And I spoke to Jim McLean, obviously this was the second time he attempted to sign me. So I says, where do I go now? I spoke to Jim McLean, he says, I want an answer by Monday. I says, well, I'll need the weekend anyway to think about it. And I sat and I said, no, I'm going to take a move that I never thought I would take. And I phoned John Clark. And I says, Dundee United made an offer of £82,000 for me.
Oh, great.
Dundee United have made an offer of £82,000 for me.
Aye.
Okay, leave it with me. I think that was Saturday night. On Sunday, I had the papers. Dundee United made an offer of £82,000. Mm. So that was me for sale.
Mm-hmm.
So, 2 days later, I told Jim McLean I was still thinking about it. 2 days later, Big Billy made an offer of 92,000. Mm-hmm. Right, now they had already set the day to.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of
not
bank
their money.
So what happened then is that Thursday, he phoned me, Fergie phoned me and says, come in the morning at 47, collect your books. I says, aye. I says, aye, make your way to Glasgow, slammed the window.
That was it.
I wasn't allowed to say cheerio to my pals and players. Teddy Scott, who had a great relationship, was the kit man, great guy. I was just allowed to say, see him to anybody.
So within 24 hours, you've signed for Celtic and you made your debut against Rangers at Parkhead.
That's right. It was a good tackle.
You wouldn't even have time to get nervous, would you?
No, there wasn't, because we drove, me and my wife drove down, met Big Billy and the coachman, and signed the deal. And Big Billy had obviously learned from Jock Steen was getting the headline in the paper the next day, so the headline I'd signed, so he stole the thunder for
everybody,
the Rangers, you know, back page of the sports. That I was making my debut, I'd signed on Friday, made my debut, in which I did. So it was a good, fabulous feeling to run out.
Do you remember the kickoff?
Wee Doddy came in, tried to do me, and I done a wee black curl flick. He slid by me, and I stuck a 30-yard pass out of David Crawley.
No, that was a member. That was fantastic.
Yeah, so,
especially McDonald's,
it's lying
by.
That's right, because it was an
O.A.
Big Roddy scored the one at that day. Roddy scored me a header for a corner kick at the Celtic end, aye. And I was denied a goal myself. I always remember by the Girvan Lighthouse. Mike McCloy was in goal. He tipped one over the top right-hand corner. 30-yard shot.
The sad thing is, you just signed for Celtic and then you get an injury, it kept you. You missed the Real Madrid games and you missed.
No. That was after a year. In fact, 79, 80. Real Madrid game was when? 81.
March 80.
March 80, was it? Well, March 80. Well, I had a niggling knee injury and I had a bit of bone floating about in my knee. And I played in the first game. Real Madrid game 1-2-0. Wee Doyle with Rest and Tommy. I've got a great picture of the four years with sombreros on. And played quite a significant bit in the game. And always, in fact, it was with Big Billy last fortnight ago. And I asked him, I said, boys, I've always, I was at a charity do with Tommy's cancer charity in the Thurston Hotel. And I was looking after Big Billy and Liz. And McGarvey asked me to do it. And I said to Big Billy, I says, boss, can I ask you something? And Big Billy's not as bad as people think he is. He's still in good nick. And he says, I've always wanted to ask you a question about when you put me out, you booked an operation. Do you not think that maybe you could have left that to the end of the season? Because I was able to play. Mm-hmm. It was just after the game, it was sore, but I could probably have pain. Once I got running and warmed up, it was fine. Aye, he says, me and John looked back and I thought, maybe we should have put it back to the end of the season, because certainly missed it.
Because we blew the league that year, and you and Tommy Burns, what if you recall us, but were injured for quite a period, and the midfield fell out of blazes at that point.
That's right, because we had that, you know, solidity. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a good pattern and a good...
And then you had to move Big Roy into midfield, which wasn't ideal, which meant the defence wasn't as good as it could have been.
We didn't have that backup.
Everywhere was getting affected at that point.
That's right. So it was unfortunate, but really I recovered quite quickly from the... Well, I was out for about 6 weeks. I mean, the damage was done by then.
You missed the cup final when McCluskey got the winning goal against Rangers.
Well, I'll tell you that, because I pulled a thigh muscle at Dundee United in the last game of the season, and I thought you might have put me in the bench. I was 80% fit, and I always remember he took me down to Seamill and he put me through a fitness, and Scotty says, I think he's all right, but what he did is he wanted to get Bobby Lennox his last medal. So he put me Bobby in the bench.
Sentimental reasons.
Mm-hmm. So I missed out because of that.
So McGarvey signed in the March of 1980, and it came for a lot of money. There was a rumour at the time that some of the other players resented, but he paid.
Not yet. That's just stories that the press can agent to sell newspapers. No, Frank was a character. Him and Reid Doyle were always having a wee go at one another, a bit of crack, but they were good, they were Celtic men, you know, so.
Well, that brings us on to Doyle. I mean, they say Doyle was a great impersonator.
Well, Doyle was brilliant. Doyle was brilliant. He used to do Big Johan, he used to do Big Billy, you know.
Big Edmondson.
And
obviously joking. Mr. Steen brought me here, and all I do under you, Mr. McNeil, is sit with scarves on my bum, you know. So, Mr. Steen, he was just a minor who got lucky.
Places and stitches.
He did a good Desmond White one
and all, apparently. He done a fantastic Desmond White. Remember, we were all sitting when we drew on the Saturday, which is a defeat for Big Billy. Big Billy's just a bad loser, you know. Even at a draw was something he crack up at. And Monday morning, we're all waiting there. Arthur Billy came around and was sitting there, and we Doyle pipes up because at the time, David Provin had just signed a contract. Charlie, was my boy, came to live up beside me in steps and took me to training every day. That's my boy still. Talked to him on the phone to this day. They were trying to get Charlie to sign. I was talking to Charlie going to Liverpool and Arsenal, etc. And me Doyle piped up. In the Desmond voice, you know. Now, Charles, I know you are a Celtic supporter. We all know you're a Celtic supporter. We all know you want to play for Celtic. We all know Celtic's in your heart. And I want you to play for Celtic. And I'm quite prepared, Charles, to give you the moon when David Provin's finished with it. So David just signed a contract. So the dressing room was absolutely, we were doubled up, laughing at that. Who walks in? Big Billy. Oh, you can laugh. Oh, you can laugh. After Saturday's result, you can walk laugh. They'll just get your running shoes on. So we're just going to shout our own run.
So, well, Charlie Nicholas then, the 1980, he made the breakthrough that you're referring to Charlie now.
Oh, Paul. Next day.
Aye.
Oh, Charlie Nicholas.
Charlie Nicholas. Yeah. What I was going to say was that very few players made the impact when he broke into the team like he did. Was it obvious to you that when he was bubbling under that he was going to be something?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt, because we used to play games at Barrowfield and Big Bully's favourite, after we did our training and our routines and our shooting practice and all the rest of it, we always finished with what we called Big Bully, we called a mad mental, which was 20 a side. Right, it was either a first team outcome, it was either more of a first team squad against the reserve team squad, but it would be 20, 21 a side. And Big Bully would play in the left wing and one team, and me, John, would play in the left wing in the other team. Mm. We always played in opposite teams, and you had to give Big Bully the ball, you know. Mm. Yeah, so he touches and played his left foot. Always wondered about how good he was with his left foot. But Charlie always stood out in these games, you know. He'd beat four and five and six players.
Even as a boy, yeah.
Even a boy, yeah. And so did Paul. Paul's the same. In fact, Paul had as much skill as Charlie, if not more, in scoring and when pass player. But unfortunately, Scottish football got hold of, as in SFA football under their one Mr. Roxburgh, got hold of Paul. And to me, within a period of 6 months, Paul went from beating three and four players, going into the box and sticking the ball past the goal, past the goalkeeper, to playing crossfield football. Mm. Yeah, so, although he fitted a new style of football, I always felt he had more to offer in a forward running situation, like, you know, like Gerrard, like, more attacking than holding in the way they wanted to play the Roxburgh methods of playing, you know.
Because ultimately with Paul breaking through, that was bad news for you, because essentially he was your position.
Well, not really, because we played quite a few games together, you know. And he was home there last year, the year before last, and I met him, and he's a lovely, lovely boy. And, you know, and obviously, they get the nickname of Maestro, and somebody says the maestro, and I was standing there, a thing called you're the maestro, and he says, no, I maybe a name he gave me, he says, but he was the master.
To you?
Uh-huh. Mm. And he does me good. He was a lovely boy. But no, I played really, I mean, he didn't push me out of the team as such, because we did play together for quite a long time. It's just the fact that, and obviously I was getting older.
Mm. Because there was a period there that, that there was a game, I'm sure you might remember it, Celtic played Aberdeen at Christmas time, just after Christmas, and we got humped 4-1.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I think Aberdeen had maybe a 4-5 point advantage in the league. And round about New Year, things didn't look good for us. And yet we went on an unbeaten run between that January and the end of the season.
Uh-huh.
And everything, for some reason, everything just clicked. And the recollection I've got at the time is that Danny was at right back, you were right midfield, and David Proven was right wing.
Mm-hmm.
And you, for some reason, everything just clicked into place.
Yeah.
And we started beating teams 3-4-5, not every week. It was incredible to see the difference between that day at Pataudry, which clearly was a bad day.
Yep.
And yet that was, it's as if you got it out of your system.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
Everybody just got doomed to the end of the season.
After three years ago, we our right wing partnership, you know, was strong, you know, it was sturdy, for the one to be able to say, as the one at Aberdeen with Stuart Kennedy, because we knew how to help one another, we knew how to work for one another, and we had an ethos of it, you know, helping one another and making sure our side of the park was secure. It's just something you work on. It's obviously something that develops in its own way, you know.
But that was the great thing about that team was it upheld the Celtic tradition of attack and play.
Yes.
I mean, they played some of the best football. I mean, I can get back to Jock Steen's time.
Uh-huh.
And that's a favourite period of mine, running about the early 80s, because just it was you, Murdo McLeod, Tommy Burns in midfield. You know, there wasn't any this nonsense these days about holding midfield players.
No.
Player in that team was geared for attack.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, that was Big Billy's way, but I mean, then Stevie, that was the Celtic way. You know, that was the Celtic way. Methods and systems started to change in that era. Probably Fergie was one of the ones in Scotland that started to change systems, you know.
He'd marry a European tactic.
Used to
come to Parkhead and sit in with nine men behind the ball and hit in the break.
He had every tactic. Fergie had every tactic. He would play with a big ball. I remember coming back to Germany one time. I mean, you beat 4-0, I think it was Borussia or Hamburg or something like that. And they came out with this ball, and it was a bigger ball, it was the Adidas ball. It was bigger than the Mitre that we played with. And we just couldn't handle it, we couldn't play with it. It was like a Super Bowl, it was no other place. So we come back with the Fergie day. Fergie ordered for them. Right, and see whenever Celtic Rangers come up, he threw one of the boys out. It was supposed to be playing the Mitre. But we were training with him every day. I remember Big Roy put man right out into the sea. And one of these boys, he wasn't used to it. They couldn't control, he was bouncing after. We were just wee things like that. Fergie was, you know, changing nets to stripes, to thingies, and, you know, bring your part in.
Attention to detail, wasn't it?
Oh, it was one at all costs.
So what was it? Do you have a favourite goal then? You didn't score many goals, but you tended to score a good one.
So the one that somebody brought to mind there was, we were through, some of the boys here would take me other games and second division games, mixed boys, we were through to Stirling Albion, and there was a Stirling Albion supporter, Big Polish actually, saying, you know, get me a bandit, he says, we were minutes away from
Norton Zoot.
Norton Zoot. Says, and you hit one for 30 yards, and he says, it's right in the top corner of the net, and it was at Celtic again. So I remember that in particular, right? And then we went on and beat him. Tommy scored. Part of Tommy scoring the last goal. I think we ended up, we beat him 4-2 in extra time that day.
But there was one day at Tynecastle, there was a brilliant goal. No, because it was a You scored the goal, granted, but
it was just executed.
The build-up.
Yeah.
It started from our own half, and we moved right through it at the park, and then at the edge of the area, I think Burns played into McGarvey, but you ran off the ball, and McGarvey, being the player he was, turned it into you,
right.
and everything just clicked into it. It was a wonderful goal. The movement off the
obviously
ball that
Frank
day
was terrific. Obviously, Frank didn't know what he was doing that day, because he never passed the ball to him. The squiddly diddly just didn't. Squiddly had his own way of playing, and nobody else could, you know.
He was very effective on McGarvey.
Oh, he was effective. He was light with the Celtic players, no doubt about it. He was wholehearted. He still is wholehearted, you know. Somebody was talking about the other day and how times have changed, but in that team in particular, I think there was about maybe 8 or 10 years, could have seen out of Rice. We were Rice every fortnight. Because the fact was, Steve, there wasn't big money between us, you know. We were not on much of a sameness, unless you play. I think you get an extra 20 quid or say, or something like that a week, if you were an internationalist, you know. That was in the structure. But as far as the wages, the basic wages the same for everybody, and the bonus was the same, so there wasn't any animosity between who somebody getting more than others. And we had a great relationship with the wife, so I knew when I was still there this day.
John Doyle's death must have been a big shock at the time. I mean, it was a shock to us as fans, but
it's amazing
to somebody like yourself.
Yesterday, because a fortnight again, when I was at Celtic, and I had the wee business, I had to give the business up because it was frowned upon that I should need to have other employment.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough. So my hobby was do it yourself. And I remember a fortnight before it, Doyle took me down and showed the house he'd bought. And it was on a corner.
That's in Kilmarnock?
Uh-huh. It was on a corner. And it was self-built, this builder had built it himself. And he showed me, it was a bungalow, he showed me the planning to take a room upstairs for his son. And I said, that's feasible, it's not feasible. And I remember saying to him, I said, but two things you don't touch, water and electricity. Which wouldn't, it never crossed my mind that it'd be any other way. Unfortunately, what happened? Is that builder apparently had two phases of electricity in it of two different supplies, which I don't think is legal. I don't know the implications of it. But Doyle thought he switched the electricity off, but he'd only switched one phase off.
Mm-hmm.
So you get caught between a metal upright, which again, why it was in a, you know, he got between a metal upright and the cold water tank, caught in between it. That earth. And his son was there, and his son had touched him, his son would have been right as well. But I remember the night it happened, we were talking about the other day, we were not a function thing, it was about the same crew I'm talking about, maybe 8 years, at a function with wives, and we ended up in the town for a drink after it, at 10:30 at night, and Tommy was there with Rosemary. I remember Tommy getting a phone call, and he told us the tragic news, and we were just dumbfounded, we all just got up and left at the same time, all went home. You know, and obviously waited to the next day when it ended. It was very sad. It was just great. We Doyle, up the earth, sort of mischief and carry on, honest to God. Things he'd done. He wore a cross, right? And I was telling a guy yesterday, he wore a cross. He went through the side of this cross, it must have been 4 inches, right? Or 2 inches, and I don't know the time. And the referees used to come and say, Mr. Doyle, we need to turn it off. He said, no, that's my faith, I don't need to take it off. And he said, well, you'll need to do something. So Doyle would tape it and make it a Celtic cross.
Across his chest,
the hairs of his chest, and used to go out from the referee, you know that. But before he did, he would do that, he would always remember the urine and look at your boots. And that's that one side of Doyle, and Tommy Burns sat the other side of Doyle. And Doyle would be sitting down, this referee would look at his boots, and Doyle would know of his background, let's say, you know. And there's this big chain on his neck, and Doyle would just start going like that. And the big crush would just, you know, across in front of his eyes like that, and we would just start the tears running out of our eyes. He would do it all the time, by the way. If he knew they were, you know, if they were all persuasion, you know, he just drank with it. It was funny, it was really funny, honestly. This is the sort of thing you come.
So, but by 1983, you're coming to an end of your Celtic career. And that was some of the football he played that season. That was the season Nicholas got 48 goals. Mm-hmm. Was outstanding, and yet ultimately ended up in disappointment. Is it a fair point to say that the media thing around the media circus around Charlie at the time dragged us down a wee bit and it affected the rest of the gang?
It probably could have done. I mean, you don't like many excuses when you know, the capability was there. Dare say people had money on their mind, I don't know, or dare say Charlie had other things in his mind. But really, you can't just put your finger on and say that was that, you know. We still scored an awful lot of goals, so we must have given an awful lot of goals away. Mm-hmm. You know, so we must have had a problem, really, a defensive problem.
See, what I was trying to allude to there is I get the feeling watching it at the time that Charlie was playing for his cell at that point because he had an opportunity, a transfer.
Well, it could very well have been that, but that could be influenced again by the media. And Charlie, again, was one of the first to have an agent, so he could be influenced with the big agent. A big London agent, you know. So that's a good shout. And obviously, it ended in the fact that myself, Charlie, and Big Billy all left at the end of that season.
And George McCluskey as well.
And George.
Who was a big player for us at that
point. Yeah.
So, not many people appreciate that you actually played for Manchester City.
Well, Big Billy took me down there, yeah. And I only played a couple of games. I was down there for about 3 months. It really wasn't working out because I was travelling back and forth. My wife wasn't prepared to move down. Big Billy was still no sure his position, so he wasn't able to commit a situation that he wasn't able to follow right through, you know. So I come back up the road and I signed for Dundee United. Eventually signed for Dundee.
Eventually, after all the years.
Yeah, Jim McLean. But McLean wanted me, I was still wanting to run, which I could, I was still fit to run. I'd seen openers want to go, but he wanted to play me a whole different way. He wanted me to be playing Ian Phillips. Remember Ian Phillips played in front of the back four? He wanted the defence to give me the ball. And because I knew I could pass the ball, I could hit good diagonals and fine passes. That's the role he wanted me to play. He wanted to play in front of the back four, pick up the ball and make these diagonal passes for Stewart and these boys, because they'd running players. Mm-hmm. But I still seen openings and I was wanting to make runs. So he says, I'm getting wrestling. So he says it was never going to work out, you know. So let's go. And I signed for Morton and enjoyed my time at Morton.
There's one game I need to bring up. My brother was a Morton fan, and it was a horrible, horrible, peeing wet day at Capital. The likes of McClare was in, and Davy Proven was still there, and Mo Johnson, Paul McStay, they still had a wonderful team, and yet Morton finished 2-1 at Capital. Jim Gillespie scored twice. So you were pulling these things in midfield that day.
I was captain that day. I was captain of the team because it was a horrible clash with Wee Murdo. Wee Murdo ended up, I think he ended up in hospital. I think he tried to do me right enough, but I don't know what happened. But the way he fell, he ended up with quite a bad face injury, I think Wee Murdo got. Didn't make any difference to his looks.
Did you enjoy it, Capital?
Loved it, Capital, because it was there. Jim Duffy was there. Mm. You know, I went to Andy Ritchie. There were some good players there as well, you know. I enjoyed more 3 years at Morton.
So looking back at your Celtic career especially, who was the one abiding memory? If you had to pick one thing that stands out for you, what was the one thing?
See, there's lots of great memories, you know, but probably running out for your first game is something nobody will ever...
It wasn't just a normal game,
no. It wasn't a normal game, it was an Old Firm game, you know, a sellout capacity of 900,000. So there's lots of great times, lots of great memories, players with the players, great games, Juventus games, Liam Brady, the team that beat us over there, 9 internationals in it, I think.
Cruyff as well, Ajax.
Cruyff, but the Juventus game in particular, they had 7 players in that team that won the World Cup that year, Juventus, you know. So teams like that, you know, Graham Brady, David Jersey after a game match.
Still got it?
No, that's another story.
I thought you might have it up here.
No, it disappeared on the way back.
Did you keep jerseys? Was that the kind of thing you did?
No, he gave me it. He said, if it's not your particular good game, sir, and you look for a jersey back, and I said, I'll try and get one of you, because we weren't allowed to get a jersey away.
Celtic being Celtic.
But the jersey disappeared out of my bag. I subsequently found out who took it. In fact, David Probin highlighted the fact somebody took the jersey. Big Bully wasn't into that type of thing, that why should we get beat, why should somebody get it? So the jersey mysteriously disappeared out my bag.
Oh, so somebody's got it somewhere then?
Well, I don't think it. Somebody's son was wearing it for quite a while, you know.
Right. One of them ones. You've been kind enough to give us your time, Dom. It's been really nice talking to you. If the people who are listening here, like, Dom's bar's just open, and the natives are getting restless, so all that is left to say is thanks very much for your time and taking a wee trip down memory lane.
Thanks for coming along, and thanks for putting me out to your followers.
No bother.
I wish you every success in the future with your ventures of podcast.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that chat between Dom and St Anthony, with a bit of trip down memory lane and also an insight into the way that football used to be with different players in a different time. Now, you know I like to finish the podcast with different music every week to try and fit the occasion or whatever it is. And I certainly am not a music snob. That's either music you like or music you don't like, and each to their own. You might not like some of the music I've played, and you might, it's up to you. Anyway, you'll follow us on Twitter. Might have seen a bit of debate between Lackeymore and St Anthony and I over music, and particularly over those two guys having a liking for Dire Straits. As St Anthony did the podcast, I've been thinking and wrecking my mind about what sort of semi-soft rock, badly clothed, denim-clad music from the mid to early 80s I could put on the podcast. So after looking through the 9,000 or so songs I've got on my iTunes library, I realised I don't have any of that crap. So here's something else from the early 1980s. It's more my kind of stuff.